Hello. So I'm from the Euro-Mediterranean Seismic Center, which is near Paris. And I'm going to talk to you today about how we use Python to help us detect earthquakes. But actually not detect earthquakes from seismic data, detect earthquakes just simply for monitoring the rate of visitors coming to our websites and using our app. And in fact, we find that we can detect the earthquakes before we get the seismic detections just by doing that. So I'm going to talk first about my work, our work, and then I'll talk a bit about how I use Python to do that. Let's skip one. So the EMAC collects seismic data from 131 seismic institutes in 84 countries, and it collates the data streams. So in fact, we get multiple detections of the same earthquake from different institutes, and we basically merge that data set into a superior single data set. And we get a lot of earthquake reports every year. Last year, we had about 50,000 earthquake reports. So the map above shows seismic detection stations in Europe. It's particularly dense in Italy and Austria and stuff, but lots of parts of the world it's less dense than this. And each organization monitors the seismic waves and tries to detect earthquakes from those waves. And they can normally do that automatically in a few minutes, but it does still take a few minutes to do it, mostly because the earthquake waves have a limited velocity and they take time to spread. And you need a certain number of stations in order to re-triangulate the origin and the time of the earthquake. And actually, Python's becoming very popular in the seismic community. Already there's a library called OBSPI, which if you're interested, you can check out. But we've known for many years that we can also detect earthquakes when after certain earthquakes, people come to our website. And we initially discovered this the hard way when our servers struggled and we had a denial of service. Well, we don't have that anymore, but we've instrumented our servers to tell us very accurately when we have new visitors to our website. This was an earthquake in July in Turkey. It was a magnitude 6.6. And you can see that within a couple of minutes, we're getting significant visitors on our website and also people opening our app. And we actually detect that peak within a minute or so. Actually, we detect lots of peaks. This was just from the last couple of weeks. Most of our peaks are a lot smaller than the one I showed you before. I picked a nice big one for the first graph, but most of our peaks are just a few thousand people coming to our website. But we detect about 40 peaks per month just by this method. And they can be even for quite small earthquakes. So if an earthquake happens to be right underneath a town, we might still get a peak because eyewitnesses don't know whether it's a big earthquake far away or a small earthquake right underneath them, and they want to know. They want to know right away what's going on. This is what I was talking about before. What we see here is a graph of when we detected the peak versus when there was an official publication of an earthquake detection, and it's negative. We're actually detecting the peaks up to 5 minutes, or sometimes even to 20 minutes before there's any seismic detection. This really gives us an advantage on our website, because what we don't want is people coming to our website after an earthquake and not seeing anything, and then they think that we don't know anything about earthquakes because they know more than us. So we use this data to, because as I said, we had 50,000 earthquakes detected last year. So we use this data to help us filter out about 2,000 earthquakes that actually people might be interested in finding out about. So we don't present them with a list of thousands of earthquakes they have to weed through to get the one they want. This helps us really present a smaller list that will be useful for them. So on the left is our website, and on the right is our app. They both show the same list. So with this data, we can geolocate the visitors by their IP addresses, or we can find the geolocation from their mobile phone, and then we can start mapping out where our peak in traffic is coming from. This was the peak in Turkey I showed before. I don't know how clear it is, but there are people visiting, coming to the site, and we're plotting them on the map in a cumulative plot of visitors over time. You can see that people come within a few minutes of the earthquake. So I made this map using generic mapping tools, which I'm going to talk about. Generic mapping tools is a favorite of the geophysical community. It's a bit getting a bit old now, maybe. It consists of about 80 command line tools with very cryptic command line switches. But it is extremely capable, and it produces PostScript files, which is obviously useful for when you want to do articles. So rather, a lot of other stuff does interactive maps, but if you, it's not as easy to make that image you need for your article. And it also is very has a lot of choice in the map projections. It's, you know, so if you're a power user, it becomes more interesting. And I interact with generic mapping tools with GMTPy, which is a very thin wrapper for calling the commands, and it just makes things a lot more convenient to use from Python. It helps you stream the data into the each command, and it turns the command line switches into function parameters. So this is an example of how to make this map. You create a GMT instance, and then the GMT executables become method calls on that instance, and the command line parameters become parameters to the function. And then you can stream the data directly into your function call. So that really helps. But actually, we've just started to use a new library we've just found out about. It's called Folium. So given everything seems to be Jupyter Notebooks these days, Folium integrates very well with Jupyter Notebooks. And in a couple of lines, you can have an interactive map and plot your data on it. Underneath, it's using the Leaflet mapping library, which is a JavaScript. And we actually find this is pretty nice. In general, there's lots of useful packages in Python for geographic work, but that's an entire talk by itself. So it's not enough just to detect the peak. We also want to know where it is. And we find that doing a cluster analysis on our locations works very nicely. Because we don't have a lot of locations, we can do a hierarchical agglomerative clustering model. And we use a SciPy cluster hierarchy module. And I accelerate that with the fast cluster package, which gives us a bit of a speed boost. And this really helps clean up, because there's a lot of noisy locations, it's good to reject those locations and give us the biggest clusters and find a good epicenter. And there is now there's alternatives as well. Sklearn is becoming increasingly good. Okay, so now I'm going to talk about how I implement this, because everything has to happen in real time. We want to do everything as fast as possible. So this is my system. It's a series of Python processes, and it's all tied together with a system called RabbitMQ, which is a messaging system. So the green circles are RabbitMQ exchanges. I'm going to talk about RabbitMQ next. And the processes are the boxes with names in. So we have a WebSocket server that sends us a message every time a web page is opened or shut, and it goes to watch visitors, which then turns all that information into sessions for the visitors. And then when a new session starts, we use the new visitor process to analyze it, and in that way, we don't get any slowdown on our main process. So that's how we can really field out the work. And this helps us stay up to in real time, not have any pauses. And obviously, it's important for us to try and filter out robot peaks. We don't want to have false triggers, and we have various filters in place. So RabbitMQ has really changed the way we work, and it really makes writing real-time systems a lot easier. It's is a messaging broker for sending messages between processes, and messages go to exchanges, and each message will have a routing key, which is like an address, which will become useful in a second. So clients, they create queues that they attach to the exchanges, and the queues fill up with messages for the client to process. So the Python process doesn't have to worry about the keeping up with the messages. It just has the RabbitMQ stores the messages until the Python process can process them. And the queues can filter the messages from the exchanges using the routing keys on the messages. So you can create a complex of systems as you like. You can have multiple workers looking at feeding off one queue, or yeah, you can, it's as you much, 3 minutes. So I use the Pika library for using RabbitMQ from Python. It's probably the best known library for interfacing with RabbitMQ, and it's used in all the tutorials on the RabbitMQ website, and they're actually very well done, so I suggest you look at that. And I use you're not going to learn much from that, but I use a class for robustly connecting to the RabbitMQ server and reconnecting when there are dropouts. This has basically come from an example in the Pika documentation. And it basically all comes down to one method call, which is like called new message, which handles all the incoming messages. So Pika becomes your event loop in this scenario. So then what I do is, once I have the sessions, I write session data and metric data to a PostgreSQL database. Obviously, I use SQL Alchemy. When I started about 4 years ago, there wasn't so much buzz around time series databases such as InfluxDB or React.ES or etc., Prometheus. I do it differently now. Actually, I find this works pretty well. And we use Grafana to monitor our traffic in real time, which is a dashboard. So you might think of this as just used for operations data normally, but actually you can kind of reapply it to scientific data if you have any real-time data you want to display. And we do that using a package called Graphite API, which is a stripped-down fork of the Graphite monitoring system. It's written in Python. It's a simple package compared to the full Graphite, and it just runs under a server like Apache or Nginx. And the important thing is you can add a custom backend to this system. So any kind of data you can imagine, you could write a backend and have it displayed by Grafana. And it's well documented in their documentation how to write the backends. And I think that can be quite useful for a lot of people. So last year we detected 307 traffic peaks out of 50,000 earthquakes, and it helped our public outreach because it made us more relevant to the public. And it also helped us ask eyewitnesses to fill in the questionnaires for us, and we got a much better response rate by targeting them with banners on our website and notifications to our app. So I just want to thank the EMSC team. These are my coworkers, and I hope you maybe found some interesting ideas from how we do work at EMSC. Thank you very much.
One small quick question.
So it was a great talk, thanks. But the earthquake in Ischia, like 2 weeks ago, I think it caused a lot of damage, but it was really I think it was really low. It was like something like four. I don't know, really low, but you hear about sevens in New Zealand, but this was a four, and it caused loads of damage. So do you, like, so on your site, like, I noticed there was a kind of ranking by strength of earthquake. So does it matter, like, the strength, or when you're noticing these peaks, or well, is
part
it
of, part of the
same?
Point of this system is that we don't just rank earthquakes by their size, because, like you say, there's a smaller earthquakes can cause damage, or they can be very close to a town, and people are interested in those peaks. We've had detections of peaks as small as magnitude like 2.8. That's a tiny earthquake. You probably won't even notice it if you're not sitting down quietly. That's why this system's useful. It's like another way to filter our earthquakes.
Okay, let's thank the speaker again. And next up is Johannes talking about